yay, oh yay, oh yay, the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and its Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Morning. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050027, G. Byron Collum, M.D. and others versus Sharon Boyd from Tarrant County in the Second Court of Appeals District, and 050812, State Farm Life Insurance Company versus Tony Watson Martinez from Brazos County in the Tenth Court of Appeals District. Justice Heck is sitting in both cases but is unable to attend argument this morning. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument, and we will take a brief recess between the arguments. The proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050027, G. Byron Callum, M.D. and others versus Sharon Boyd.
May it please the court, Mr. Birdwell and Ms. Rosenberg will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Rosenberg will open with the first 7 minutes. Mr. Birdwell will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court, good morning. If I may, I would like to start with the preliminary issue of the recent developments of the facts of this case and discuss what I believe are the dispositive effects of those events. As the court is no doubt aware, the parameters of this case have changed dramatically on June 28th this year when Ms. Boyd passed away. The open courts doctrine on which the Court of Appeals made its ruling to reinstate a portion of Ms. Boyd's claims is not available to rehabilitate the survival claims of the estate that remain in this case. Accordingly, the Court of Appeals decision should be reversed. It's important to consider first that this court can consider Ms. Boyd's death and then that the court should. On September 22nd, David Allen Boyd Jr. petitioned the court to substitute for the respondent in this matter, and petitioners agreed to that substitution. So we have an agreement at this point that the estate should be substituted and the court should consider this as a survival action, which it is. In Smith v. Hanger in 1950, this court said that, in fact, such a substitution was proper while not required, and that, because certainly Rule 7 says that the appeal should proceed as though the death didn't occur, but this court has said that that's a procedural rule only, shouldn't affect the substantive rights of the parties, and that this court should, in fact, consider the death, and should where that is both economical and will tend to expedite the disposition of the case. The fact of the matter is, open courts is inapplicable to survival actions, and a survival action is all that remains in this case. And so the question that was pending before the court prior to Ms. Boyd's death is no longer necessary to be dispositive in this instance. This court has an opportunity instead to make a rather simple ruling on the basis of what remains at this point in time. The court has repeatedly indicated that open courts is not applicable in survival actions. The court said that in Bala versus Maxwell, said that again in the Ald decision, and that is all that remains to be considered here. So we would ask the court to consider that in making your decision. Beyond that,
just to be perfectly clear, what are you asking us to do on that basis after the developments this summer?
We would ask the court to affirm the summary judgment of the trial court based on the ground that was before the trial court and before the Court of Appeals at the time, which was the limitations bar. The ground for summary judgment in this case has not changed. It has remained consistent throughout. At one point in time, the respondents had what can essentially be deemed an affirmative defense to an affirmative defense. in the context of open court, that affirmative defense to the affirmative defense of limitations has evaporated. It is not available to the respondent at this time, but that doesn't change our ground for summary judgment. Our ground for summary judgment was that the limitations bar applies. It applies in the same way that it always has. It's simply there is no longer a response to that affirmative defense that was perhaps available at earlier points in this case.
And the unavailable argument is that, in response to your position, is at least as you put it, is that the because the survival action is a statutory claim, not a common law claim, the open court's argument is not available.
That's correct. Beyond that, if the court has no further questions on that issue.
Well, it seems pretty simple, and there haven't been a lot of questions here, I guess because your argument's a little different. Is there something that perhaps we are missing? I guess you wouldn't know that if the bench is not very hot this morning.
I've noticed that. It's not what I expected. But I think that this has changed the nature of this case. It's changed the nature of this case dramatically. And it's something that provides the court with an opportunity to render a decision without wading into the more complicated and perhaps more controversial matter that was before the court, which has to do with the relevant standard applicable to the open courts, the use of open courts in misdiagnosis cases. The fact that Mrs. Boyd has passed and therefore this is no longer a common law cause of action provides the court with that opportunity should it choose to do so.
Well, let's get to those merits. Did the was her claim cut off before she knew or reasonably should have known that she had this condition?
Before she knew or reasonably should have known.
And is that the standard or is it a possibility standard? Let's get to the merits.
The standard is not new or should have known. In fact, that's the discovery rule standard. And this court has said repeatedly that that the Health Care Liability Act has eliminated the discovery rule in medical malpractice cases. What we're talking about here instead is the constitutional standard, which is a much higher bar applicable to the open courts provision. The court has repeatedly said that the standard there should be reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong. So the question before this court is, what does it mean to have a reasonable opportunity to discover your wrong? And in misdiagnosis cases, the Boyd opinion as it stands now would tell you that where there has been a misdiagnosis, you have no reasonable opportunity to discover your wrong. And we would submit that that's not the standard. Instead, what the court should be considering and what the court has, with the exception of the Hellman decision, considered over the years is whether something is impossible or exceedingly difficult to discover, and which only makes sense. Something can be both reasonable. In this circumstance, it could be both reasonable for someone to seek a second opinion and reasonable for someone not to seek a second opinion. The question is, was there a reasonable opportunity? And seeking a second opinion in this case was, in fact, a reasonable opportunity under these facts. And in many misdiagnosis cases, that's going to be the facts. That's going to be the opportunity. And so that should be the standard at this point in time. I'll let Mr. Berg continue with that. Please.
In essence, what the court is looking at is the determination of what is the significance of two reasonable alternatives with regard to the constitutional imperative. If these facts are such that it is reasonable to inquire, but are equally reasonable with regard to not inquiring, as the Court of Appeals suggests here, that Ms. Boyd can stand on the diagnosis of hemorrhoids, and that is equally reasonable, does that implicate the constitutional question? Does it make it impossible, if you will? Our argument is that it doesn't make it impossible, and impossibility is in fact the test. The question is, could she have, not should she have? And by, by focusing on Hellman, where the court, we believe, went further than the open courts doctrine and focused on the should have, not only to the should have, but went all the way to actual confirmation of the misdiagnosis. In other words, basically went past the objective should have standard and went to the completely subjective standard. That's what the Court of Appeals did here as well, by essentially holding that Ms. Boyd could simply rely on the diagnosis of hemorrhoids and not go any further, was under no duty of inquiry from that point in time, and therefore could just simply wait until she eventually had a confirmation of the earlier misdiagnosis that she alleged. The court is essentially not only adopting the discovery rule, but jettisoning the objective portion of the discovery rule, and in saying in all misdiagnosis cases that there has to be an actual confirmation of the misdiagnosis for there to be any triggering with regard to the duty of inquiry. Now, that's contrary to this court's earlier jurisprudence, and it's also contrary to the court's jurisprudence specifically with regard to fraudulent concealment. And it's important here, I think, the court to note that Hellman is different from Shaw and from Earl v. Ratliff in one distinct category, and that is, in the latter two cases, the court was dealing with both the doctrine, the open courts doctrine, and the doctrine of fraudulent concealment. Whereas in Hellman, there was no allegation with regard to fraudulent concealment, for obvious reasons, because the person who was sued was simply a pathologist who had made a diagnosis that was alleged to have been a misdiagnosis earlier and had no continuing relationship with the particular patient. So there was no opportunity, if you will, to fraudulently conceal the alleged negligence. Now, when this court took a look at the facts before it in Shaw and in Earle, the court was dealing specifically with fraudulent concealment before it went on to the open courts, and the court effectively merged the two concepts. In Bordelon versus Peck, this court held that knowledge of such facts that would put a patient on notice of a possible need to inquire further, and if such inquiry would lead to the discovery of the underlying wrong within the limitations period, that knowledge of those facts is knowledge of the underlying cause of action as a matter of law. And in Shaw, although the court does not expressly do so, same thing with regard to Earle, the court effectively makes that the standard with regard to open courts, and it only stands to reason. If you are aware of facts, that it would be reasonable for you to inquire further into those facts, then that is all the Constitution requires. You have the opportunity. The Constitution says nothing about whether you should inquire about those facts. The Constitution simply says all you have is the opportunity, that the circumstances with regard to the statute of limitations do not make it impossible or exceedingly difficult for you to make that reasonable inquiry.
So do you think that Nagel versus Nelson was correctly decided?
Based upon the facts of that case, I believe so. The question here is whether or not the parents in that case were aware of diagnostically significant information in order to know that they reasonably could have gone further and made that inquiry. And there was reason to believe in that case that was not the case. Here, we have a woman who is aware. The record is clear that she is aware of the diagnostic circumstances she is addressed with, is looking at. And the Court of Appeals basically rhetorically denigrates her personal and professional experience by simply saying, well, the doctors had superior knowledge. Why should she be forced to diagnose when they didn't? And from a rhetorical standpoint, that makes sense. It's also the essential argument that's being made by the plaintiff in the Axelrod case that the court is going to hear in February, where the plaintiffs are arguing that, well, there's no duty to self-diagnose. But, of course, the defense in that case is not arguing that there was a duty to self-diagnose. The question is there a duty to act on your awareness of diagnostic significance of your circumstances? In that case, of your symptoms, in this case, not only of the symptoms, but also of the specific test that is involved.
Is that duty affected in any way by the fact that she was a nurse?
Your Honor, a patient has a duty to act as a reasonably prudent person under the circumstances. Her circumstances included the fact that she was a nurse. Now, the standard is not necessarily one of a reasonably prudent nurse because she is not acting as a nurse under the circumstances.
So you wouldn't apply the standard differently for somebody who is not a nurse?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, this is not an argument for a duty to self-diagnose. This is not an argument that says, in fact, she had an opportunity to diagnose herself. No, this is an argument that says she was aware of her circumstances and the diagnostic significance of those circumstances. She had three negative tests from three previous fecal occult blood tests. She knew the significance that they were negative, and effectively what the Court of Appeals does is the Court of Appeals says, well, we will credit that knowledge because then that means she can rely on the diagnosis of hemorrhoids because she has a negative test here. But with regard to the fact that she doesn't complete this diagnostic test, which is not an annual well woman, it is specifically prescribed for her worsening symptoms, she knows it's a diagnostic test because she doesn't complete it because the bleeding she's suffering renders it non-diagnostic. She also knows that she didn't complete it, even though her symptoms were worse.
Well, why didn't she complete it? Why didn't she complete it?
According to the record, she contacted the, if I may, Your Honor, according to the record, she contacted the doctor's office and said, look, I have read the packaging. The packaging says that if I am actively bleeding, that this is a non-diagnostic test. What does, you know, should I do that? Should I take this test when I'm actively bleeding when the package says it's no good if I do that? She talked to a nurse. The nurse said, well, clearly if the package says that, then don't do it. I'll talk to the doctor. The doctor did not get back with her according to her own testimony, but that does not relieve her of the awareness that a diagnostic test that was not given to her to confirm hemorrhoids, but to determine whether there was something else, was not completed. That was the opportunity.
Justice Wainwright.
I'm sorry.
Dr. Thompson said in her deposition that there was no reason that Boyd should have known she had colon cancer. Doesn't that create a bit of a hurdle for you if one of the doctors says there's no reason that she should have known? And then the doctor's office, when she called to say, should I take this take-home test, told her, no, you don't need to. You're kind of putting the patient in a bit of a corner, aren't you?
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
Even if a patient has symptoms of something very serious, in this case colorectal cancer that was not diagnosed, and there were multiple examinations, multiple well woman examinations over the years going back to 1996, and so she goes to the doctors, they misdiagnose it as hemorrhoids multiple times, they give her a take-home test, take-home test says under the circumstances you're experiencing, don't take it. She calls the doctor's office says, yeah, don't take it. And then another physician, Dr. Thompson, says there's no reason she should have known she had cancer. You don't see a fact question at least sufficient for the jury?
No, Your Honor, I don't. And the reason I don't is because Dr. Thompson's question goes to the ultimate issue, i.e., again, it's back to this concept of self-diagnosis. If she's self-diagnosed, that's not the test. Okay? His statement that she had no reason to self-diagnose is not the test. The question is, was she aware with regard to the inquiry, which is all that the Constitution requires? And when you combine her clear understanding of the diagnostic significance of her negative tests with her father's history, with her own knowledge from her own professional experience.
And she had polyps removed herself in the early 90s. But what should she have done then? She had multiple tests, went for examinations, had a take-home test she was told not to take. What more should she have done rather than ask and be examined by two different doctors and been told that it's not cancer?
With regard to my particular client, she still had a full year within which to do something about it. Within that period of time, she did absolutely nothing. What she should have done is she still had the test. When her bleeding stopped so that the test was diagnostic, she could have done that. If her bleeding continued, that means her symptoms worsened, which means that she was not being diagnosed. She could go back to see the doctor and give that opportunity to find out what, in fact, is going on. Again, she had the opportunity and reason to inquire.
Counsel, your time has expired. Are there further questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Fillmore will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. My argument this morning will focus on 2 points. First, that the petitioners at this point are barred from raising Sharon Boyd's recent death 18 months into the pendency of the petition for review in this court, 10 months after the full briefs on the merits were completed, to raise that as her death as a new ground for affirming the summary judgment, as a new ground for challenging Boyd's rights under the open courts. And second point is that on the merits of Boyd's open courts defense, the record is replete with evidence that shows that she did not have a reasonable opportunity to discover her wrong during the period of limitations, and therefore that the trial court's summary judgment was erroneous. Now, with respect to the first point, the language of Rule 7.1 could not be any clearer. It specifically says that if a party dies after the trial court renders judgment but before the case has been finally disposed of on appeal, the appellate court will proceed to adjudicate the appeal as if all parties were alive. Now, we've exercised our ethical obligation to notify the court that Sharon Boyd had died back in June. We did not in any way, shape, or form agree that that fact can now be injected into these proceedings for an on-the-merits ruling of the parties' positions.
But the problem is you're asking us to declare a statute unconstitutional as applied. And we try not to declare things unconstitutional, especially shortly before a new session starts up, unless we just have to.
And I believe the court has to in this case, Your Honor.
Well, but we could remand for, these new facts to be taken into account before we... I mean, if she's right, and it is true, survival actions are statutory, and that makes your case go away. We're just kind of gratuitously declaring something unconstitutional, which we know is not going to make any difference.
2 points, Your Honor. First of all, I think the court can remand it back, because I think under Rule 7.1, the court must proceed, as the rule says, to adjudicate this as if she's alive. The court must then address the issue of whether she had a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong. And in that instance, the court should conclude, I think, as the Court of Appeals unanimously and properly concluded, that there's evidence in the record to show that she did not. In that instance, the case should be remanded back to allow us the opportunity to develop a record, that would respond to this new changed circumstance. But in particular, Your Honor, if the court follows Rule 7.1, the court should address the error the Court of Appeals correctly found and identified in the trial court's ruling. And in that instance, it's to correct the error. To correct the error also would require the court to correct the erroneous effects of that error. And in this case, the erroneous effect of the error was to deny Sharon Boyd her opportunity to a trial on the merits on her open courts defense while she was alive. Now, at the point in time when the trial court ruled, back in September of 2003, we know that she lived for another 2 years and 9 months while we tried to get that error straightened out on appeal. Now, but for the trial court's error, Sharon Boyd would have seen a trial on the merits in this case. She would have been given the opportunity, therefore, to preserve her open court rights in a verdict and a judgment that the law is clear thereafter could not be taken away from her because of her death.
Is there any authority for that?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe there is, because the circumstances of this case, cry out for the court to exercise its equitable power.
But I mean, what you're arguing is that the trial judge didn't put you to trial fast enough. The open court's provision would require us to disregard the fact that a survival cause of action is statutory.
No, Your Honor, what I'm asking the court to do is, this case was specially set for trial in October. I believe it was October, certainly within the year. The summary judgment was granted in September. She lived for another 2 years and
but the trial judge had just gotten busy trying other stuff, and it had taken 2 years, and she had died.
But that's
your argument would be
My argument would be...
In other words, if the judge had made one mistake rather than the other.
My argument would be, Your Honor, in that instance, well, of course, that's not what happened, but my argument would be in that instance that just like what happened in the Ault case, in the Balla versus Maxwell, and in the Mark v. Catterson, the patient expired before they ever had an opportunity to make it to the trial court to preserve their rights. But that's not what happened here. What happened here is we know she lived for another 2 years and 9 months.
But I guess back to my question. We've never said that your opportunity to bring your claim means your opportunity to get a verdict. We've just said it's been an opportunity to file the case.
Well, I believe the court...
When have we said it means opportunity to get your case to a prompt trial?
What
open courts means.
Well, I think the issue, Your Honor, is she should be given the opportunity. Open courts guarantees her a remedy.
This is easy. You said there's authority.
Yes.
I want the name of it.
Okay, the authority is, Your Honor, I will give the court I apologize, Your Honor, but the Johnson versus Cherry, 1987 Supreme Court case, where this court said that the equitable power of the court exists to do fairness and is flexible and adaptable to particular exigencies so that relief will be granted when, in view of all the circumstances, to deny it would permit one party to suffer a gross wrong at the hands of the other. Now, Your Honor, in this case, it is fundamentally unfair for petitioners, by their own malpractice, to render what was otherwise a treatable and survivable cancer terminal, and then, by the trial court's erroneous ruling on their summary judgment motion, to effectively run out the clock on Sharon Boyd's constitutional rights, such that now...
But, we don't draft statute limitations.
No, Your Honor.
Those people do.
But the court has the
And your argument would be if instead of a couple of years, if there had been a couple of decades, would be exactly the same. In other words, if somebody says they could have discovered the cancer in 78 and it wasn't actually discovered until 2000, your argument would be the same. She had no reasonable chance to discover it, and therefore, right?
Yes, sir. If she didn't have a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong, which we don't believe she did, whether it occurred that far back as the court's question or here where it occurred only years back,
since we've done all these cases on the open courts, legislature's passed a statute of repose for Med-Mal cases. We're going to declare that unconstitutional, not in force here, but your argument is we'd have to declare that unconstitutional in my hypothetical case, too.
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm arguing. This court in Bordelon versus Peck recognized on equitable estoppel principles that a health care provider, by their own fraudulent concealment of their wrongdoing, can be stopped from alleging the statute of limitations defense. Now, we're not asking the court to go that far in this case. All we're asking is that they ought to be stopped from asserting her death as an independent ground for defeating her open court's rights for the period of time between when the trial court erroneously granted the summary judgment and the time, the 2 years and 9 months that this case was on appeal while we tried to correct that error. The court can do that and remand the case back and give us 2 years and 9 months, the time that this case was on appeal, trying to correct the trial court's error, for her to have an opportunity then to present her case, her open court's defense, to the fact finder and obtain a verdict and obtain a judgment that thereafter her death could not take away.
So all of your claims are statutory at this point?
Yes, Your Honor. The way this court has interpreted the interrelation between the survival statute and the open court's defense and 4590I, I believe that's right. The claims are statutory.
And what you just said before answering this question is an argument for us to change the law.
I don't believe it is an argument to change the law. I think it's an argument, Your Honor, for the court to exercise its equitable power, just like it has done before, in this exact same 4590I, based on equitable estoppel principles, prevented a defendant from profiting from its own wrongdoing, being able to then turn around and assert a statute of limitations defense. That's all we're asking the court to do, not even go that far. They still have their statute of limitations defense. We just have the right. They're just to stop from asserting her death during the time period that we know she was alive and would have made it to trial and been given the opportunity to preserve her open court's rights.
Mr. Fillmore, if we do that, aren't we saying that their wrongdoing was in the appellate process as opposed to the misdiagnosis? How did they, it's by asserting their rights in the trial court and then by this process going through the appellate system, how do we call that their wrongdoing?
I think it's twofold, Your Honor. Their wrongdoing, in the first instance, and there's evidence before the court right now to show this, that it was their negligence, their malpractice.
But that's the question of malpractice on limitations in open courts. That goes to the merits. But you're saying that somehow their wrongdoing has stretched this beyond her death. But isn't that really the procedural process of how we handle cases? Wouldn't we be calling that process their wrongdoing if we do what you're asking us to do?
I don't think the court would necessarily have to call it wrongdoing. We do know if the court reaches the merits, as the Court of Appeals did, of their summary judgment motion, that it should never have been granted. It should never have been granted.
But how do we call that somehow the fault of the defendants for making their argument?
I don't know that the court, I don't believe the court necessarily has to call it their fault. It's an interplay of two things, their underlying malpractice that caused her death, that they're now wanting to turn around and assert, forecloses any further inquiry into whether she had a reasonable opportunity to discover wrong, whether the Court of Appeals and the trial court erred, forecloses any further inquiry into their liability for causing her death, and effectively gives them a defense that they did not have while she was alive. Now, I think the court, and I could analogize this to the instance where if the trial court erroneously grants a J&OV, the case goes up on appeal. This court turns it around. It gets remanded back, and the court's function is to put the parties in the same position that they would have been in had the trial court entered the correct judgment.
So if there were a trial, would there be... How would it look? Would there be an instruction to the jury that you're to consider this case as if she were still living for this 2 years?
The jury would never know, Your Honor, because that's a purely legal issue about the effect of her death on her open court's rights.
Jury wouldn't know what?
The jury wouldn't be asked to make a finding about whether she was alive or not. The effect of her death is a purely legal issue in terms of her open court's rights. The only thing that would be submitted to the jury.
So then as a legal issue, the court would consider the case as if she were still living?
Yes, Your Honor. The only issue to be submitted to the jury was, did she have a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong? That's the issue that would have been submitted to the jury had the trial court not erred. But what I was saying in terms of remanding it back in the context of the J&OV, the court then, and there's a line of cases that hold this, the court then calculates post-judgment interest from the date of that judgment, putting the parties back in the same position they would have been in had the trial court not erred.
Mr. Fillmore, let me go to the merits. And you said you would ask the jury, did she have a reasonable opportunity to discover? What kind of instruction would you give to the jury on that that would be different from the malpractice limitations question that she knew or should have known? How would you differentiate those two?
The issue, I would give them the same instruction that this court, based on what this court's specific holding was in Nelson versus Cruiser.
On the reasonable opportunity you're talking about now?
Yes, Your Honor. And I'll turn to the second point here, that's the merits of this appeal. It was in Nelson versus Cruiser that this court first applied the open court's provision to strike down the statute of limitations in the context of a patient who did not, or plaintiff who did not have a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong.
You believe Nelson's your best case?
Yes, Your Honor. Nelson versus Cruzan. And Nelson has never been overruled and has been repeatedly cited with approval by this court in all of its open court's decisions, almost all, I should say. But in Nelson, the court specifically held that because the open court's provision operated to cut off a plaintiff's rights before they knew or should have known, specifically said, knew or should have known, that the limitations provision was unconstitutional.
So how does that differ from your malpractice standard?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because except for she is an individual. These are physicians. There would have to be evidence of the standard of care by which these physicians.
What is your instruction to the jury on reasonable opportunity if you're going to submit that to the jury?
Yes, Your Honor. The instruction would be she did not have a reasonable, the jury's instructed that Mrs. Boyd did not have a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong if she did not know nor should have known of her injury before it was diagnosed on April 12, 2002.
What's your limitations instruction?
I think the statute of limitations, Your Honor, would be at that point as a matter of law because there's no question.
Same instruction.
Well,
same standard.
If there's even a reason to submit it to the jury at that point.
Okay, but I'm saying that what you just told me on reasonable opportunity didn't you just say it's exact same standard as the statute of limitations defense? Either she knew or should have known.
Yes, Your Honor.
So we don't have any difference between open court standard and medical malpractice, the statute of limitations defense.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right, and I think that's specifically what Nelson versus Cruzan holds.
Except that in Diaz, in 1997, we said there is no discovery rule in medical malpractice actions, and the legislature followed suit with the statute that abolished
it. Interestingly enough, in Diaz versus Westfall, Your Honor, the issue was never before the court. The court did not ever get to the issue of whether it was knew or should have known or knew or could have known because, in that case, the plaintiff was dead, and so the court resolved that case on the ground that she didn't have a common law right. Now, what this court has said, though, in the case of Chilkworth versus Heisen, I think is instructive on this point. The court there, that's a 1999 Texas Supreme Court decision, the court said, in Morrison versus Chan, we held that absent a violation of the open courts provision of the Texas Constitution, 4590I abolished the discovery rule in cases governed by the Act. Now, what the court is saying, and this is all Nelson versus Cruzan said, is the discovery rule was a rule that was enacted recognized by this court to apply to accrual statute of limitations. That is, statute of limitations where the plaintiff's cause of action was barred depending on when it accrued. The court said 4590I doesn't turn on, its limitations provision doesn't turn on accrual language anymore. Therefore, we cannot use the discovery rule as a rule of statutory interpretation. The very next page, the court says, but we do adopt it as the standard by which to determine the open court's rights, because the court recognized the legislature does not have the power to cut off a plaintiff's cause of action before they knew or should have known that they had a cause of action, before they knew or should have known of their injury.
And let's talk about the facts some in that regard. Obviously, Ms. Boyd was presented with several misdiagnoses of her condition. Isn't one drawn to the inescapable conclusion, reading the facts from either brief, yours or your opponent's, that she was troubled by the diagnosis, that she knew something wasn't quite right? That's why she kept going back? Is that why she asked another doctor? Is that why she called about the take-home tests? There was something that didn't quite add up in from her perspective. Don't you agree?
No, Your Honor, not until the end, not until 2002. I think the court goes back and looks at the records. These visits where she's going to her health care providers are well woman examinations. They're not there. She's not there because she's bleeding. She's there for other reasons, and she reports intermittent bleeding. And to a person, it's not just one doctor who told her this. It wasn't just two doctors who told her this. It was three. All three of her providers said, you have nothing but hemorrhoids. You have nothing but hemorrhoids. And in fact, Dr. Thompson gave her this take-home fecal occult test that they want to talk about, his office thereafter told her, don't do it because you have bleeding hemorrhoids. It was only a month later than in February 2001 that she goes back to petitioner Dr. Kelly. And it's undisputed that at that point, he puts an endoscope in her rectum and tells her, I can see the bleeding hemorrhoid. Now, their argument is that because she had it was possible for her to leap off the table and say, I don't believe you, I want a colonoscopy, then she can be deemed to have constructive knowledge of her cancer from that point on. Now, that's not the law. That should be the law, and that conflicts with Nelson versus Cruzan and Hellman versus Mateo.
So if the standard is exceedingly difficult or impossible to discover, your client loses.
I don't think so, because in this instance, there really isn't much.
Oh, you just said she could have jumped off the table and said, that's not right, something's problematic with that. That's possible, not impossible.
The way this court has interpreted this impossible condition requirement, it is not a theoretical impossibility. And for instance, in Nelson versus Cruz, the injury was symptomatic, as counsel admits. The injury was symptomatic during the period of limitations.
Mr. Fillmore, in the last 3 seconds, do you take issue with the characterization of this case now as a survival action?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I think at this point in time, the court must continue to adjudicate this case as if Sharon Boyd was alive. I also would point out, Your Honor, that Sharon Boyd did not have colon polyps removed. I thought I understood the court to say that. That's not in the record. Her father did. And the evidence is clear in the record that those were not cancerous. They were not cancerous, and there's no evidence to say that they were symptomatic in any way or that they were those symptoms were in any way comparable to what she was experiencing.
So what was the procedure in the early 1990s that she had?
She didn't.
She didn't have any?
No, but it was her father who had colon polyps removed.
Well, I'm aware of the father. I thought there was some indication in the briefing, at least, that she had some similar procedures in the early 90s. There were none?
None. I mean, not that I recall, and I think I would know that. I hope I would. But no, Your Honor, did not have any proceeding like that.
Really quickly, I know you take issue with the characterization of this case as a survival action. Putting that disagreement aside, do you agree or disagree that the open course provision is flatly inapplicable to survival actions?
Not in this case, Your Honor. I don't.
Based on your equity arguments earlier?
No. I also believe, Your Honor, that the court in Ault left standing a severability argument that it resolved based mainly on language that was unique, statutory language that was unique to the capping section of 4590I that does not appear in the statute of limitations section of 4590I. And I can briefly explain that if the court would like, but I'm out of time. I did tell the court that I would provide a post-submission brief that would address the supplemental brief that came in on the eve of oral argument.
Counsel, if you want to briefly explain, you give 30 seconds or so.
Thank you, Your Honor. What in all, the court addressed the severability issue, which is the issue of whether, because the Constitution was the capping section was unconstitutional as applied to a live plaintiff's claim, could the court sever out its arguably constitutional application to the dead patient's claim? Now, the court said yes, we think we can, because the capping section has a specific provision that says this cap applies notwithstanding the survival statute. The court looks over at section 10.01, the statute of limitations section. There is no language like that. I think that goes to the point that the legislature would never have passed a statute of limitations, the efficacy of which turned on the patient dying. They would not have given the health care providers the benefit of a defense if their malpractice managed to kill the patient. And I think that argument is left outstanding from the Ault decision.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel.
I think I used most of my original argument. A couple of points. First, with regard to whether or not open courts are currently available, the equitable argument the council makes is effectively to say that the court can, through resort to equity, change what is a clear statutory cause of action into a common law cause of action for the purpose of applying a doctrine that only applies to the common law. Now, if the court wants to open that Pandora's box with regard to, you will have claims with regard to every statutory cause of action that the open court's claim does not apply to now. So the appeal to equity, while I recognize it, is to actually appeal to alchemy, if you will, to transform a statutory cause of action into a common law cause of action in order to apply the open court's provision. With regard to your question about wrongdoing in the appellate process, Your Honor, it's easily answered. The Court of Appeals found that at least part of the appeal was meritorious.
there's no allegation at that point or here that anything that was done with regard to the appellate process was frivolous, and respondents have had that opportunity to raise that if in fact they wanted to. So there is nothing upon which the court could find some type of estoppel effect that the court found with regard to fraudulent concealment and was appropriate with regard to fraudulent concealment. Finally,
why shouldn't we send this case back to the trial court for you all to brief some of these issues?
First, there's not a dispute as to the fact of the death. Second, you're dealing with a clear issue of a judicial economy. And the court's case law with regard to summary judgments, and the reason the court finds that it can go ahead and grant and affirm summary judgments based upon grounds that were already presented to the trial court, I think is what applies here. We asserted the statute of limitations. That defense has not changed. That defense is still available for the court to affirm, and that defense is what the trial court gave us the summary judgment on. The Court of Appeals is the court that found that there was a means for avoiding it, and that means is no longer available due to her death. And so there is nothing to be gained with regard to sending this back to brief to a... I'm sorry, Your
Honor. The trial court granted summary judgment. She wasn't dead.
That's true.
So you didn't have the argument that you're making now at that time. I mean, I understand your argument. Your argument, our position is still the same. We win. But the reason we win has now changed.
And this is the court that needs to be able to make that determination one way or the other. The Court of Appeals is going to be bound by the court's earlier decisions. We will go back. If the court sends us back to file another motion for summary judgment, the trial court is simply going to say she's dead, it doesn't apply, and we'll be right back up. So from a judicial economy standpoint, if they're going to make that argument needs to be made here and have this court make that determination now.
And you're absolutely certain that's what the trial court's going to do? Isn't that why we have trials, and why we present motions to trial judges, and why trial judges have the opportunity to take evidence if they think they need to and hear argument and do things that we can't do?
There's been no suggestion as to what evidence might be necessary at the trial court other than her death. The trial court is necessary for a finding of fact. The fact of her death is not in dispute here.
But as pointed out, the trial court hasn't had an opportunity to rule on the argument you're making now about the survival action.
That's true. That is true.
And what happens in a scenario where there are other cases where facts are similar to this? And you know, I can envision a party appealing and going through the appellate process in hopes that the other party dies so that the issue's never resolved. So why don't we just resolve this issue here once and for all so that some sinister lawyer didn't take the approach, well, let's go ahead and appeal this and hope the old coot dies and you know, we'll go from there.
Well, two aspects in terms of responding to that question. One, if in fact there's some type of delaying tactic on how part of counsel, the trial court is in position, and the Court of Appeals are in position to deal with it through the frivolous appeal. I mean, the trial courts are in control of their own docket with regard to that. But second, this would go to the decision in Roe's procedural issue about if there is something that can occur, that some wrong that the court can address, but is not likely to get to the court, for in that example, pregnancy wasn't going to last more than 9 months and it wasn't going to get to the Supreme Court until long after that, then the court can go ahead and address that issue. And this is a similar context here. The court has the fact before it, has the law before it. This is the court that is capable of making that determination.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.